I think we've got several gone to hear the last performance of the Christian School Chorus for this year. So I know we've got that several out, but we're going to continue to talk about Israel's history in 2 Kings. We'll talk about Elisha, but we're going to talk a little bit about Israel as a nation for a moment. Why? And so we'll just, you participate with me tonight. Why do nations take over other nations? Israel does. Israel's taken over by its neighbors and then at times takes over its neighbors. What reasons typically lead to that? Put the people in slavery, more power, more laborers, wealth, natural resources is a lot of times because there'll be agreements and conquering because of all of those. We get workers, we get wealth, we get resources, okay? Tax money is a huge part of it. Maybe we don't get along. Some of it goes back to old grudges. You remember? You know, hey, you didn't help us back here, and now we're powerful enough, we're going to get you. But we find out that Ahab had conquered Moab. And now Ahab is gone and his sons aren't as strong. And so the king of Moab rebels. And so we've got Israel wanting to go back and take Moab back. And so he gets Jehoshaphat, who is king of Judah, who is a good man, and the Edomites, and they're going to go together and conquer Moab. Do you have any idea at least what part of the taxes that Moab was paying to Israel? State of Tennessee, Steve, is ranked number two in goat production in the United States, right? That's right. Any idea how many goats in the state of Tennessee?
Second most in the
country. About 115,000. About 10% of what's in the state of Texas, which is the largest goat producing state. But there's about 115,000 goats in the state of Tennessee. Moab was supplying 100,000 lambs a year to Israel. And the wool from 100,000 sheep a year to Israel. So basically, all the goats in the state of Tennessee every year were going as payment of part of the tax or part of what they owed having been conquered, plus the wool. The reason I ask you that, Steve, so there is a purpose. That gives you, you know, how many goats we don't see, but I mean, to be number two in the country, you can figure that's quite a few, that's a lot of goats. And you take in a small area, but that was actually sheep. But sheep and goats were their mainstay. But man, that's, you can understand why they wanted to get out as for Moab, for lots of reasons, why they wanted to get out from under the control of Israel. That's pretty expensive taxes, isn't it? But that's what they were paying. And you can understand why Israel wouldn't want to give that up. That's pretty significant. So Moab has rebelled, and now Israel and Judah. Now, when I say Israel and Judah, do we know, what are we talking about when we talk about Israel and Judah? Yeah, right. We've got Israel to the north. We've got Judah to the south where Jerusalem is. So this is all the Israelites, but they have divided after Solomon. All right? So we've got Israel and Judah who are God's people, but they have divided, and now they have joined together to bring Moab back under the control of Israel, and again, to take from their production, from their wealth. And so as they're going out as one, and they're going through the desert of Edom, and the king of Judah wanted to know, is there not a prophet that we can go to and ask before we make this attack? And they said, well, there is Elisha, who, and this is interesting, who used to wash the hands or pour water over the hands, I believe is how the new NIV says, used to pour water over the hands of Elijah. And so they go, let's go inquire of him before we go into battle. Now, if you remember, Elisha was not a man of who minced his words, neither is Elisha. He is not overly politically correct. Again, the king of Judah, Jehoshaphat, is a good man, and he comes to Elisha. But Elisha says to the king of Israel, he said, aren't there some of your father's prophets and your mother's prophets that you could go inquire of the prophets of Baal? And the king, no, we wanted to inquire of God. And Elisha says, if it wasn't for the king of Israel, I wouldn't even acknowledge you're here. I mean, that's the disdain that he has going back to, as you remember, the problems with Ahab and Jezebel. But he tells them to go ahead and to attack, and he gives them a sign to show that what he's saying is true. He told them to build trenches in the valley and said, it's not going to rain, but those trenches are going to be filled with water, and your animals will be able to drink from them. So they dig trenches, and sure enough, in the night, water starts coming from Edom, and it fills the ditches. Not a rain, water just flows and fills the trenches, and so their animals are able to drink. But the Moab realizes that these three kings have come to attack them, and they look, and the ditches look like blood, look like they are filled with blood. And they are scared, and they start to flee, and the armies of Judah and Israel and Edom begin to conquer them and destroy them. Now, Moab's king is an idol worshiper. And so he stands up on the city wall, and he offers his son, who is the heir to his throne, as a sacrifice. And then the passage is a little unclear, and I will read that at the end of 4. Verse 26. And there, the battle, they have been slaughtering Moab. It says when the king, you can bring it up, Mike, if you want to, 426, or 326, excuse me. 326. We'll read it together. Now again, he is doing this as the battle is against him. He is making a human sacrifice to his God, hoping to turn the tide of battle. When the king of Moab saw that the battle had gone against him, he took with him 700 swordsmen to break through to the king of Edom, but they failed. Then he took his firstborn son, who was to succeed him as king, and offered him as a sacrifice on the city wall. The fury against Israel was great. They withdrew and returned to their own land. And scholars really are not sure what that means exactly, because obviously his God is not real, and the Lord had been delivering victory to Israel. Kind of in reading, I don't know whether it emboldened those who had survived to see him offer his son. I mean, the heir, obviously that was a tremendous thing, and they fought with greater fury, and Israel decides to withdraw. Not sure, because obviously he is offering a human sacrifice to a pagan god, which would certainly not have turned the tides for many, many, many reasons, because number one, the god wasn't real. But the tide turns, or Israel withdraws, and they don't conquer them, but they do defeat them. And maybe it's very much like we saw in World War II, that the Japanese tended to fight long after it was apparent they were not going to win the battle, but they fought with great intensity and great commitment, till the very end. And maybe these folks really gained a great deal of intensity when they saw that their king had offered his son. But interesting, as they tried to take back Moab. Now, Moab plays some significance. Where had we seen Moab prior to this, where it was significant? Who was from Moab? Yes. Yes, Ruth. Ruth was a Moabitess. That's exactly right. In time of famine, Elimelech and Naomi had gone to Moab. And their sons had married. And so Ruth, who then becomes part of the lineage of King David and the lineage of Jesus, is from Moab. But Moab then survives its independence. And there is continuing battle in the area, as we know, between Philistines and Amorites and all of those different nations as they fight back and forth. And idolatry continues to be a problem, even with the kings like Jehoshaphat and Josiah and others who do a pretty great, good job of turning Israel. They're still never able to completely stamp out the idolatry of the land, the high places and those worships, and they move back to that very quickly. Now, we're going to study just for a moment from 2 Kings 4 about Elisha. We saw a lot of the stories about Elijah, about the ravens feeding Elijah, and Elijah, the widow and her son being fed with the meal and the oil through the famine. And we're going to see some of those same things with Elijah. And we'll just kind of read through these. The three was really too long and a lot of information, but we'll look through these. The wife of a man from the company of the prophets cried out to Elisha. She's a widow of one of the prophets. Your servant, my husband, is dead, and you know that he revered the Lord. But now his creditor is coming to take my two boys as slaves. Slavery actually was part of Israel's culture, even under the law of Moses. And people could enslave themselves for at least a period of time in payment of debt. But there were always real restrictions on debt and on crediting and on charging usury and all of those things. And the law would talk in some ways about compassion and dealing with that. But here we have a man who must have died in some kind of debt, and so the creditors are coming to take her sons as slaves. Elisha replied to her, "How can I help you? Tell me, what do you have in your house?" The servant says, "There's nothing at all except a little oil." Elisha said, "Go around and ask all of your neighbors for empty jars. Don't ask for just a few. Then go inside and shut the door behind you and you and your sons. Pour oil into all the jars, and as each is filled, put it aside." Now, what's Elisha said to this woman? And what's the test here for her? He said, "Go get a bunch of jars," didn't he? The way it's translated, the way words is, I'm not talking about a few. He's saying, "Go get the jars." And really, she is going to reap a blessing from God through the prophet Elisha, and it's going to be based largely on what? How much she's willing to believe, and how many jars she's willing to work and get. She doesn't understand that, I don't think, at this point. But, you know, he told her to do it. And I don't know, that was, you know, it would be awkward. Somebody comes here, "Can I borrow your jars?" "Well, why?" "Well, I'm for some oil." "Well, we're all poor." You know, they might know the situation. And she's got to express and show some faith. And, you know, "Well, I need more jars." "Well, how much oil you think you're going to get?" And the reason I say that, sometimes we remove, when you go ask people, there's going to be a lot of questions, right? People are going to be nosy. People are going to question that. People are going to doubt what you're doing, right? So she goes through this and she's asking. And I bet she asked some people, maybe she didn't want to. But she does, and she gets all these jars and they go in. She left it, and afterwards she shut the door behind her and her sons. They brought the jars to her and she kept pouring. When all the jars were full, she said to her son, "Bring me another one." But he replied, "There is not a jar left." Then the oil stopped flowing. So what happens? As long as she had jars to fill, there was oil to fill them. And it seems like there was just a little flask with a little oil in it. And this is probably not, this is an oil for anointing, for pouring on you, you know, it's not Wesson oil, but it would have been more of a perfumed lotion type oil. And so she has just a little bottle of it, and that little bottle keeps flowing until all of the containers she has. Now, before we move on, just a second. If you kind of remember the story, and I'll just tell you, we don't know how many jars she had, but how significant was the amount of oil she got? Anybody know how significant? What do we know she was able to do with the oil? You guessed right. She was able to sell it and pay her debts, and there was enough left over for paying the debts for her and her sons to live on. So, I mean, we're talking about a significant, I don't know what she owed, but there's enough oil that she's able to go and sell, and this must be a commodity or something that was readily sellable at the markets, that she was able to pay her debt and to have more for her and her sons to live on. So, not only did the prophet and God help her get her debt problem dealt with, but actually assisted her in what she needed to live, to survive. But the oil flowed to what? Not till the power ran out, but till the jars ran out, right? Till the jars ran out. Always need to remember that God can bless us in ways many times bigger than we think. Bigger than we think. We don't trust God enough to bless us, that He is big enough. Because what would this lady have been happy with? Jim, what would she have been happy with? Paying the debt. She would have been tickled. She would have been tickled if I can pay the debt and not lose my sons. But God blessed her in even a larger way than that. All right, then we'll move on to verse 8. All right, we got a woman, a Shunammite woman, and she's in a totally different category. She's wealthy, or at least very comfortable, okay? But we're going to find out that this woman is noble, but we've got a woman that's poor. Now we've got a woman who is in much better shape. But she's got a need as well. Before we move into it, as we start off, what's the Shunammite woman's need? What does she not have? A son. That's right. She doesn't have a child. So we have the woman first. And one day Elisha went to Shunam, and a well-to-do woman was there who urged him to stay for a meal. So whenever he came by, he stopped there to eat. She said to her husband, "I know that this man who often comes our way is a holy man of God. Let's make a small room on the roof and put in it a bed and a table, a chair and a lamp for him. Then he can stay there whenever he comes to us." And he travels with a servant. But this woman at this point doesn't seem to be looking for anything. She's just taking care of Elisha. And it seems that the prophets, that these people of God, were cared for by the community because of their ability to prophesy and to serve. And that's exactly what the formula for the Levites, isn't it? That the Levites were cared for by their communities. And that's why this widow is lacking, because her husband's gone. So one day when Elisha came by, he went up to his room and lay down there. He said to his servant Gehazi, "Call the Shunammite." So he called her and she stood before him. Elisha said to him, "Tell her," and this is interesting, he tells his servant to talk to her. He's called her and tell her. I'm not sure why Elisha's not communicating with her. I don't know how significant it is. I don't really have a point from it. It's just interesting to me. It's odd. You have gone to all this trouble for us. Now what can be done for you? Can we speak on your behalf to the king or the commander of the army? In other words, can we make your existence here better, more comfortable? Is there something we can do to help you gain favor with the authorities in your community? Here's her answer. "I have a home among my own people. What can be done for Elisha?" But she's saying, "You can't help me with the government or with the army because I'm at home. These are my people. This is my family. I've got no problems in that area." Elisha asked Gehazi, and he said, "Well, she has no son, and her husband is old." Then Elijah said, call her. So he called her and she stood in the doorway. About this time next year, Elijah said, you will hold a son in your arms. Kind of like Hannah, isn't it? Except Hannah had prayed for it, but remember what Eli says to her, that next year you'll have a son. And the woman says, no, my Lord, don't mislead your servant, O man of God. She doesn't ask for this. She had been looking for a son, you know, for years and years. She has given up, and it's kind of like, don't you get my hopes up. You know, I have resigned myself to the fact that I'm not going to have a son, and I've dealt with that. Now, don't get my hopes up that I'm going to have a son only for me to be disappointed. But the woman became pregnant, and the next year, about the same time, she gave birth to a son, just as Elisha had told her. The child grew, and one day he went to his father, who was with the reapers. I think this is a sad story. It ends well, as you may know. He says, my head, he said to his father. And his father told the servant, carry him to his mother. After the servant had lifted him up and carried him to his mother, the boy sat on her lap until noon, and then he died. So we know the child is obviously old enough to talk, but he's not real large. The servant carried him. He sits on his mother's lap, so he is young. She went up and laid him on the bed of the man of God, then shut the door and went out. Now, it appears that she does not tell that the child is dead. Now, I don't know, maybe some of the servants know, but she doesn't announce this. She doesn't share that the child is dead, because here's what the husband asked. She called her husband and said, please send me one of the servants and a donkey so I can go to the man of God quickly and return. Why go to him today? He asked. He doesn't know the child's dead. Why are you going there? It's not a Sabbath or a new moon. It's all right, she said. She saddled the donkey and said to her servant, lead on. Don't slow down for me unless I tell you. This is a pretty tough lady. She's kind of holding this in. She's dealing with it. So she set out and came to the man of God at Mount Carmel. What happened? What had happened at Mount Carmel? Elijah and the prophets of Baal. That event with the sacrifices had occurred at Mount Carmel. And Elisha's at Mount Carmel. When he saw her in the distance, the man of God said to his servant Gehazi, look, there's the Shunammite. Run to meet her and ask her, are you all right? Is your husband all right? Is your child all right? Everything is all right, she said. Now, he's asking because he knows apparently something is not right. But Elisha the prophet doesn't know what it is. And we're going to see that he'll make comment that God has not revealed to me what's happened. When she reached the man of God at the mountain, she took hold of his feet. Gehazi came over to push her away. But the man of God said, leave her alone. She is in bitter distress, but the Lord has hidden it from me and has not told me why. Then she says, did I ask for a son, my Lord? She said, didn't I tell you, don't raise my hopes? Elisha said to Gehazi, tuck your cloak into your belt, take my staff in your hand and run. If you meet anyone, do not greet him, and if anyone greets you, do not answer. Lay my staff on the boy's face. But the child's mother said, as surely as the Lord lives and as you live, I will not leave you. So he got up and followed her. And this lady, she's not going to share her problem with anybody in Elisha, right? She tells the servant everything's okay. She tells her husband it's going to be all right. She shares it with Elisha, and she said, you know, almost like, I had dealt with this pain. I didn't ask you for a son. I told you don't get my hopes up. Then I had a son, and now the son that I've had is taken away. And so he sends his servant. She says, I want you. Gehazi went on ahead and laid the staff on the boy's face, but there was no sound or response. So Gehazi went back to meet Elisha, and he told him, the boy has not awakened. When Elisha reached the boy, reached the house, there was a boy laying dead on his couch. He went in, shut the door on the two of them, and prayed to the Lord. The two of them, it's him and the boy, okay? It's Elisha and the boy. Then he got up on the bed and lay upon the boy, mouth to mouth, eyes to eyes, hands to hands. As he stretched himself upon the boy's body grew warm. And we've seen the same thing from Elijah, remember? Same type of event. It's interesting. Elijah turned away and walked back and forth in the room. Then he got on the bed and stretched out upon him once more. The boy sneezed 7 times and opened his eyes. Now, just an aside, there's some question in the translation as to whether the boy sneezed 7 times or whether Elisha laid on him 7 times. Elisha's son Gehazi said, "Call the Shunammite." And he did. When she came, he asked. He said, "Take your son." She came in, fell at his feet, and bowed to the ground. Then she took her son and went out. Elisha returned to Gilgal, and there was a famine in that region. All right, so Shunammite woman's son is raised from the dead. And we know there are people raised, but there are not that many accounts. I think there are 7 accounts of folks being raised from the dead in all the Scripture. And this is one of them. And we're going to see one more where Elisha now is with the prophets. They're in a famine. What do? When food is short, get what you can, right? So they're scrambling for food, and it's going to cause them some trouble. While the company of the prophets was meeting with him, he said to his servant, "Put on a large pot and cook some stew for these men." One of them went out into the fields to gather herbs and found a wild vine. He gathered some of its gourds and filled the fold of his cloak. As the old folks say, he had a shirt tail full. When he returned, he cut them up into the pot of stew, though no one knew what they were. Here's a lesson. Don't eat things you don't know what they are. But they did. The stew was poured out for the men, but they began to eat it. They cried out, "Oh man of God, there is death in the pot." And they could not eat it. Now, I don't know whether it just tasted bad or somebody got sick. We don't know. But they didn't eat it. And it must not have been a very long time because here's the solution. Elisha said, "Get some flour, put it into the pot," and said, "Serve it to the people to eat." And there was nothing harmful in the pot. Was it magic flour? Was it Martha White? Because you make right with Martha White. No. It was God working through Elisha, and this was the symbol or had what he had them do to make the food edible. So we see that Elisha, remember last week, what did Elisha ask for? Yeah, double the measure that Elijah had. And we see here he's able to raise from the dead. He's able to tell, he's able to bless those who are in the armies. He's able to change the food. He's able to help bring about this woman's having a son, and he's able to take care of the widow and her problem. So we see that Elisha continues to be about God's business. Now here's what's important that we're going to see in the days ahead, in the weeks that are ahead as we study this or as you read, that I'm not sure that Elisha wasn't kind of a servant to Elijah as Gehazi is to him. And so he had seen those things that Elijah had done. We're seeing his servant do this, but we're going to see that in all of these things that his servant sees, that he's still going to have doubts. He's still going to have fears in the future that God could deliver them. But what has God proven to do? God continued to take care of Elisha and those with whom he came in contact, especially those who sought him. And God has always done that for his people. And to remember to look for God and to trust in God is so important for all of us. And we need to be encouraged in that every day, that God keeps his promises. And here is the prophet had given them a sign before they went to battle. Remember that those trenches would be full. And God keeps his promises to us on a routine basis, because it is a reminder to us that if he keeps his promises today, he will surely keep his promises to us in the future. That Jesus is going to return. And if we forget that, then our priorities become askew. That Jesus is going to return, and God then will bring into judgment all things and make things new and right for those who are his children. If you need to come, why don't you do that while we stand and sing.